Welcome to episode 96 of the GeoTrek podcast. We're expecting an active hurricane season this year. And because of that, we brought in a very special guest, award-winning meteorologist Alan Seals, very famous along the Gulf Coast, based for many years in Mobile, Alabama. He's going to be sharing with us insights about what we can expect this hurricane season, how to better forecast, think about hurricanes, and how to communicate that with residents that may be in harm's way. Hey, if you're new to the podcast, the GeoTrek podcast explores the world to share stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. We focus on the physical aspects of these extreme events, their impacts on society, and what we can do to get out ahead of them to reduce the risk of loss of life and property as well. Well, hey, without further introduction, we want to introduce this week's guest, Alan Seals. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Yes, thank you. Happy to be here, as
Alan,
always.
Could you share a little bit about your background? Who is Alan Seals?
He's the guy who takes out the trash. In other words, I'm a normal person, except I'm a weather geek. Weather has been my profession, my hobby, my spiritual being. Grew up outside of New York City and experienced in my life just little different things about weather that always created a simmering interest. I realized that I always loved to perform, that I could combine performing and science as a TV meteorologist. So I ended up going to Cornell, get a bachelor's degree in meteorology, and then Florida State for a master's degree targeting TV. And over my career, I started in Albany, Georgia, then Milwaukee, Wisconsin, then Chicago, and then Mobile. So I went from tropical to winter to back to tropical.
Well, you've done it all. And then you spent a lot of time here on the Gulf Coast. We're excited to hear your insights as we move into this hurricane season. We thought, who better to help kick us off hurricane season than Alan Seals? So thank you so much for taking time to come on the podcast.
Thank you.
You know, I wanted to start off, hurricanes are such complex weather events, yeah. Right? We have the wind, we have the storm surge, the rain. There are all these layers of extremes, and they're very complex. What advice do you have? Like, how do you communicate such a complex weather scenario to your listeners?
Carefully. And my analogy is, how does a doctor communicate something to a patient? Doctors and scientists, we are all trained in our profession. We have our jargon, and we understand it perfectly well. But we all have to stop and realize that the average person listening to us has no clue as to what we're talking about. So I always try to make things as basic as possible. I never assume that people even know what a hurricane is, because they could be coming from another country where they never had one. And now, especially along a lot of our coastlines for the U.S., people are coming from inland states, literally, and have never experienced it. So it starts with realizing that most people don't understand what you're talking about, and then breaking it down to the most simple form.
Well, that's a great point. We have had this explosive population growth along the coastal areas, especially in the southeastern U.S., the Gulf Coast. A lot of these people are coming from Detroit, Chicago, Milwaukee, who knows where, but they've never seen a hurricane before, right?
Right. They've heard about it, and their only knowledge, unfortunately, is what they've seen on TV or social media, which is someone standing at the beach and the wind is blowing and you see the waves crashing. But very few people who've never experienced a hurricane have a sense of the tornado threat. People know the water gets rough at the beach, but they don't really know what storm surge is until they experience it, especially if they live up a river where they would never expect the river to start flowing in the opposite direction. People don't understand the difference between, for the longest time I had this, it wasn't an argument, but it was a gentleman who said to me, "You guys on TV, you always exaggerate the hurricanes. You say the wind was X, but when I look at the data buoy or the report from the weather station, it's always a lot lower. Why do you keep exaggerating?" And I tried to explain. A hurricane is not one uniform blob. It has low spots, high spots, wet spots, stormier spots. It has feeder bands, all these things that make it so complex that you've just got to start with the basics.
That's a great point. So if we have a hurricane coming in with maximum sustained winds of 95, it's not as if everywhere impacted by the hurricane is going to experience those same winds, right?
In fact, the true definition of the hurricane strength in terms of wind is the maximum recorded wind in any quadrant, not everywhere and not all over. But on the same hand, if you hear of a hurricane with a wind of, say, 80 miles an hour, it's possible at your house you could get 100-mile-an-hour wind gust from a tornado that passes by in the feeder band.
So it sounds like there's a lot of localized variability depending where you are.
That's the key. It's you're trying to figure out the local impact of something that is almost global.
Alan, when we see hurricanes covered on the media, a lot of times viewers are seeing palm trees blowing in the wind, right? That's, it seems like the most visually captivating and, yeah, and maybe the easiest thing to record. It's really hard to video a massive storm surge coming your way and survive it, right? How do you help listeners know a lot more people are die or have life-threatening conditions from the flooding as opposed to the wind when people think of hurricanes as primarily wind events?
Yeah. So my career was broadcast meteorology. I was the guy on TV and social media telling people, here's what's coming, here's how we know, here's what we think. A lot of emphasis on, even though this is the forecast, here's what else could happen on either side of the forecast. So at this point, it's all about showing people the best you can, literally an image, whether it's a historical image or a simulated image, which a lot of media outlets are doing a better job with the three-dimensional virtual reality simulations of here's what is likely to happen. So when people see it, they can understand it. And the other trick is, if you're able, go back in history and find a similar storm and say, okay, you may not remember this, but here's what happened 30, 40 years ago. But now it's going to be a whole lot different because of the bigger population.
Well, that's a great point. And a lot of times any given location on the coast might only have a direct impact, what, every 20, 30, 40 years. So yeah, you may have to go right or left along the coast to find those similar conditions that maybe happen in a neighboring community, right?
Right. And then the other issue is people say all the human nature is really incredible, even though I'm trained as a meteorologist. People say, well, how bad was the worst storm? And you say, okay, well, the winds were this, this number of people died, the storm surge was this. But they don't realize that that's not the worst it could be. That's only the worst that has happened in the past. And the cliche of records are meant to be broken, that's the case for weather. Everything that we know, there's always another level of it that we've never experienced or recorded. And that's what you really have to prepare for.
That's right, Alan. And I think it's hard as humans to envision things that we haven't seen before, right? These extreme wind events, extreme flood events, they're so far outside of our frame of reference.
Yeah.
I like what you're saying about going back to historic photos, historic videos, and saying, wow, I've never seen anything like that before, but it shows Mother Nature can do that, right?
Yeah. And with regard to the extremes, one of the biggest challenges as a forecaster is when you see a projection of something that has never happened, you're thinking, okay, can I go out on a limb and tell people that this Hurricane Harvey will produce 60 inches of rain? It's never happened. If I'm wrong, people will say that I overdid it. But if I don't say it and it happens, people will say I underdid it. So that challenge also goes into assessing a storm and predicting a storm, even local daily downpours and lightning and hail. It's really tough as a forecaster to tell people that something will happen that has never been recorded before.
I see. So it's almost like this is new ground. And like you're saying, you don't want to hype it up, but then also you want to avoid your listeners from being blindsided, right? Saying, why didn't you warn us? This is the worst it's ever been, right?
Right. Yeah.
Alan, how can you help coastal residents and residents inland as well from hurricanes and tropical storms? What are ways we can help people from being blindsided by these events?
It starts with education. And like all education, it starts when you're a child, when you're young. I still go out and do school talks, and I love to share the joy of weather and get kids to understand what causes it, what we know, what we don't know, and also to appreciate it. And more importantly, to prepare for it, which is, I mean, that's the key of hurricane season, and talking about it, is getting people to prepare. The thing I think that's most important is being able to show and teach people that this is what can happen, even though you've never seen it before. Here's how it happens, but in any given storm, we're never 100% certain what's going to happen.
Sure. So it's almost like we're thinking probabilistically, or like what's likely to happen or what could happen. But even for a seasoned meteorologist like you, you don't know exactly what's going to happen, right?
Right. There's a big disconnect with the public. For better or worse, weather apps are everywhere. And on a daily basis, you look at your app, it tells you it's going to rain where you are in 10 minutes. It tells you hour by hour what the forecast temperature is, what the probability of rain is. And when you think about weather forecasting and hurricane and tropical storm forecasting, we forecast the weather 365 days a year. But in a given community, you may forecast a tropical storm impact maybe 5 days out of the year. Sometimes you'll go years without any of it. So for as much as we know about weather, and as good as local forecasts are, the tropical forecast, still there's so much, we have less practice with it. And when you stop and think that tropical weather comes from a place where nobody lives, and there's so limited data, it just makes it hard to figure out what a storm is, let alone what it's going to become.
These are some of the challenges to forecasting, right? When we get a winter cold front coming down along the I-10 corridor, we see dozens of those every year. Right. And then the observations coming off of those are all inland communities. You can see what's happening upstream, right? What's happening in the Midwest or in the plains. We have obviously better data for that. It sounds like you're saying these tropical systems coming off the Gulf, the Caribbean, the Atlantic, we have less observations out there, and then we also have less experience with them, right?
Simple as that. In fact, when you think about storms over land, the greatest data to me now is photographs, where you could literally see the structure and what's going on, and of course video. But again, coming in from the oceans, you can see it on satellite, which misleads people. Another comment I've heard in the last few years is when people look at the high-resolution satellites, they'll say, for example, wow, that storm is so big. It covers the entire Gulf of Mexico. But it's not that the storm is bigger than it used to be. It's just that the satellite has higher resolution, and it's so crisp, and especially the visible or daylight satellite, it makes everything look tremendous, even though the core of it is fortunately more limited.
Well, Alan, you're the perfect person to bring on this podcast because you have this seasoned career in meteorology. You've been tracking tropical storms and hurricanes for more than three decades professionally and forecasting to your audience. But then you also went up in the U.S. Air Force Reserve three times, right, with the hurricane hunters as media to observe these hurricanes from the air. I mean, what did you learn about when you flew with the hurricane hunters?
Really awesome experience flying out of Keesler Air Force Base, which is where the Air Force Reserve is based. Only media observers can go. And it's basically you make an appointment and they say if we have a slot or not. And they only let two or three media outlets on at the same time. I was fortunate working in Mobile that it's just an hour away. So literally I could say, okay, tomorrow I'm off. I can try to fly and give them a call and we coordinate. So a couple of things I learned. The first one, a lot of little cool stuff. Number one, the C-130 airplane is powerful. We don't think of planes with propellers as being powerful, but those things have a lot of power. They take off. They can go up at a steep angle. It's also a very rugged plane, which is what they still fly into the hurricanes. The things that are interesting is, As you sign up and you prepare to go, you sign a waiver, which clearly says, in the worst case, you may not come back. I mean, to be honest, it says we cannot be responsible for your life if something happens. Also, a part of the waiver says that if the plane is diverted for another military purpose, you may end up in another country.
So you're reading Alan, you just can't read that fine. You're not supposed to read all that fine print there. You know right? But you're reading this stuff. You're thinking, wow, they're covering all these unlikely but not impossible scenarios that could happen, right?
Yeah. So after that, it's actually a lot like what I did as a profession, and when I talk to my friends who are surgeons. What the Air Force hurricane hunters do for them is routine. It's just a normal day on the job, and the office is a C-130, which could fly as low as, say, 1,000 feet over a tropical system that's just beginning to develop, more typically about 5,000 feet, a mile up. In the strongest hurricanes, they'll go up to 10,000 or 15,000 to avoid the downdrafts that are going to push them down suddenly. The flight itself, for most people, it would bore them to tears.
So a lot of it's just monotonous.
Yes, because in a typical storm, it takes you a couple of hours to get to the storm. And once you're in it, you're just crisscrossing the storm, going from quadrant to quadrant, and they're dropping the drops on, so weather instruments to take readings. They're using the onboard radar. They have a flight meteorologist who looks out the window, looks at the state of the ocean, how rough it is, how much spray is coming off of the waves, several hours in the storm and a couple hours back. Now, here's another consideration. If the storm is heading toward their base, they don't fly out of Keesler. They move the plane somewhere else, like Atlanta or St. Croix or somewhere else in the country. So that means most flights on average from takeoff to landing, they're 8 to 10 hours. So you're in a plane for 8 to 10 hours. You have a pilot, co-pilot, a navigator, the flight meteorologist, and then the person who drops the drops on, who's called the loadmaster. So it's just a half dozen people on a huge plane. And what most people are surprised to learn is the turbulence is not that bad in a typical hurricane. Now, part of the reason it's not bad is the hurricane hunters, with their onboard radar, if they see a strong thunderstorm right in front of them, they slightly deviate around it. So they don't go into the worst part of the storm, except when they're going in and out of the eye. And right in that eye wall, that's where you have the most turbulence.
Well, I was going to ask you, when you hit the eye wall, did you know you were there? I mean, did things really get shaking in the plane?
So my first flight was a tropical storm, which was not extreme. The second two were Category 1 hurricanes, which in the big picture, those are not as extreme as people would think of when you're in an airplane. And that's because airplanes like wind, especially a headwind versus a tailwind, depending upon what you're trying to do. So for each of my flights, 8 to 10 hours, you have your seatbelt on during takeoff, during landing, and when you're going in and out of the eye. But other than that, most of the time, you don't even have the seatbelt on. You can walk around and just make sure that you can grab something quickly. But fortunately, my flights were never that turbulent. Now, here's the coolest part. So my last flight was into Hurricane Nate in the Southern Gulf. This, I believe, was 2012. And there were two flight meteorologists on board. It turns out that those two flight meteorologists were former students of mine at the University of South Alabama. And it was the coolest thing to be in the eye of a hurricane with my former students. And they're showing me how they do their job. They're asking me my opinion on what I see. So it's just really awesome.
What a great experience. Well, you couldn't have even planned that, right? No, that your students will be there and you're having this moment where you're talking meteorology, but in a very different context.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I've heard people say, too, that have gone into that, just seeing the structure of this, it gives you more of a feel of what these storms are really like.
Yeah, you know? It clearly tells you that a hurricane is not like a wheel on an axle. It's not a solid, uniform thing. It has layers vertically, and then it has sectors, and then it has bands. When you're in the eye of the storm, or the ones I was in, which were, they were not extreme, it's not as photogenic as people expect, because as always, what you see in social media and what you see on TV is always that tiny percentage of things that doesn't represent the rest of reality.
You see like a Cat 5 with a stadium effect and you're in the eye and people think that's what the eye always looks like, right? And this is more of a high-end, perfectly developed, symmetrical hurricane. It sounds like you're saying a lot of these tropical storms or hurricanes may be a little bit messy. They're maybe large and somewhat unorganized sometimes.
The last one I was in, if the average person were in the plane looking out the window in the eye, you would just look down and say, oh, it's just layers of clouds. But I could see the broad banding. So that part said, okay, yes, we're in the eye. I also saw, which really surprised me, a couple of ships in the eye of the storm. So there were some captains who either took advantage of or made the mistake of getting in the eye and traveling with the storm.
Well, that's fascinating. Just for you to have seen that and then come back and share with us what that experience was like, you know. And you had mentioned too, people are looking out at the water, looking at the sea spray. There's some of these things even from pre-satellite times, right? That we've looked out and used the Beaufort scale and different things to say, okay, what are the indications on the landscape or the seascape of what's really going on out there?
Right? Yeah, it shows the value of the human being as a weather observing tool. Your eyes, your senses. One thing I didn't mention, which is why I was never concerned as a passenger on the plane, the track record of the hurricane hunters is awesome. They have not lost a plane or a crew since the 1950s, I think. So, again, it's a very routine task for them. They don't take risks beyond being in the storm, but they are trained to do what they do.
No, that's fantastic. Well, and you know, that's why our forecasts have improved so much as well, right? I was looking at some tropical cyclone tracks in the Northern Indian Ocean last year and some of the correspondence online, people were saying, you know, we're not flying into these. We don't know. We don't have these observations from planes. So we don't know necessarily what's going on. Alan, I wanted to bring it back to land. So back to communicating risk to your audience. So we have these meteorological factors like wind and storm surge and rain, but then also a lot depends on people's personal situation. Are you in an elevated home? Right. Are you in a mobile home? Does your house have an open floor plan? How do you communicate risk depending on people's personal situation when you're on air?
Yeah, that's ultimately what dictates the impact of the storm and what dictates what individuals should do. So, of course, I have friends and family during a hurricane and viewers and people on social media. What should I do? And I start with, what's your, as you said, what type of home do you live in? What's your level? What's your tolerance for risk? Do you have insurance? Do you have a vehicle? It's just so many personal factors that go into what generally is a personal decision. We know that mobile homes, now called manufactured homes, which are raised above the ground, are, you got to go. You have to get out. Sure. They are not going to survive, whether it's something blowing into it or the wind that blows it over. Yeah. We know that if you live in a storm surge zone close to the beach or a river where the wind pushes the water onshore and rises, and you're told to evacuate, you have to evacuate. You cannot survive water that is coming at you. But the preparation also extends to communities, as in pre-planned evacuation routes. And people who've never experienced a hurricane probably never focus on those little signs that say hurricane evacuation route. Those, of course, are to get you out of the path of the storm's threats, which the first threat is always storm surge, even though people think of it as wind. Slightly switching topics, my concern, especially as a homeowner, is my home is built to a certain building code, and most of us never really know how strong our homes are until they're tested. Yeah. But my concern is that a lot of homes are not built for the peril that exists in the community that the home is built in. Everybody wants a good deal. No one wants to pay more for something than what they feel is right. But we know that there are parts of the country that get wildfires frequently. There are parts that get hailstorms frequently. Yeah. Definitely parts that get winter storms where you have snow loading on your roof. Yeah. But it's all about trying to get the strongest house you can that's built for what can come so that you don't have to evacuate if you're not in a flood evacuation zone.
That's a good point. So if you're up above the water, you're saying if you're built for the peril of wind and you have a stronger house or a fortified house, then maybe you can actually take on a heavier wind load than someone who lives in a house that's not constructed as well.
Right. The cliche is run from the water, hide from the wind. What's interesting now, and we've seen this in some of the devastating recent storms, whether it was Texas or Florida, is you'll see a scene of devastation where an entire neighborhood is gone, but there's one house left. And that's the person who, I always use the three little pigs analogy. You have the house built of straw, the house built of sticks, the house built of rocks or bricks. You've got to build for what's there. What's interesting, though, on the downside is in that situation when your community is devastated and there's one house left, that's got to be a lonely existence.
Yeah,
to come back and your neighbors are gone. Everything is gone around you.
And yours is the only house left, right?
Yeah.
Alan, so when Hurricane Katrina, a lot of people think of Katrina as a New Orleans storm, or maybe they even include Mississippi, but they often forget about Alabama. Katrina produced a massive surge in southern Alabama.
Yeah.
I talked to friends that were down by Dauphin Island. They could not believe how early that storm surge came in. What do you do as far as communicating the timing of evacuation, especially for coastal residents that may get surprised by an early storm surge?
Yeah. So Katrina was unique in that it was a Cat 5 in the Gulf, and as it approached land, it lost strength to Category 3, which was a communication nightmare because people said, oh, it's a 5, it's a 5, it's a 5. Then it's a 3. Oh, it's only a 3, but still it was a powerful storm that had generated tremendous waves in the Gulf. It had generated that mound of water moving toward the coast as storm surge. I'll answer that with something that's happening now, which is improving. The National Hurricane Center is awesome, and they are now a lot more proactive on putting out updates whenever they can on what's happening and what's different from the last update. So that was a situation where, due to limited data over the Gulf, it's hard to track where that big push of water is going to be because you have limited number of buoys and rig platforms, oil and gas platforms in the Gulf of Mexico. That water came into Mobile and Mobile Bay, and it was devastating. It went up into our rivers, into Mobile and Baldwin counties, and surprised a lot of people who got caught off guard. And when you're in that situation, there's unfortunately not much you can do when you're caught off guard. One of my first experiences with a hurricane was when I was in grad school in Tallahassee, Florida State, and there was a Hurricane Kate hit in the just before Thanksgiving. I had no personal experience of a hurricane, and I was sitting by myself where I lived, listening to the wind. The trees were moving. The electricity went out, and I realized at that point that if you don't plan ahead, if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, there's nothing you can do. So it's all about planning ahead for what eventually is going to happen.
Well, that's a good point. You have one person that's well planned and well prepared. Maybe they built their house differently or even just have personal supplies for the hurricane season, and maybe their neighbor doesn't. Their outcomes can be really different. So how are you encouraging people with a forecast of an active hurricane season? Yeah. How do you encourage people to start preparing even before we see a named storm out there?
Right. So number one, you use the word neighbor. Know your neighbor. Unfortunately, our society is such that everyone's running and going, and you rarely stop and be what traditionally was neighborly, where you know your neighbor, you know their names, you know their children's names, you know something about them. Because after a hurricane, you will know your neighbor one way or the other. One of you is going to have to help the other. So it's a practical thing. Fortunately, after the hurricanes I've gone through, I borrowed my neighbor's chainsaws. They borrowed gasoline from me. So you're sharing. You have to. I just lost track. The question again.
In general, hurricane preparedness. And I love that you're talking about knowing your neighbors, really, because communities that are stronger and have better relationships, like you said, you may not have all the resources you need, or your neighbor may not. You're sharing from each other, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's great, building those relationships year round. I mean, and it can be a pandemic, someone gets sick, there's a car accident. Hurricanes are just part of that long list of things that can go wrong in your community, right?
Right. Okay. It hit me again. So the question is, hurricane season is forecast to be extremely active. So even there, I always have to go back and remind people the forecast is for the entire Atlantic, Caribbean, Gulf of Mexico. And statistically, based on what we know as scientists, it will likely be very active in that basin, which is 15 to 20 million square miles. The forecast doesn't really tell us what we're likely to expect in our local communities. And the analogy is, if you live in a cul-de-sac, during rush hour, traffic picks up on the main streets, but it doesn't always pick up in your neighborhood. So I don't want people to confuse what they're hearing with, there are going to be a bunch of storms where I live. And that's where people immediately say, oh, you guys said, no, that's not what we said. We said in the big picture, it's going to be active. The second caveat to that is, I'm a safe driver. I like to think I am. I wear my seatbelt. When I'm in rush hour traffic, I wear the seatbelt. But even in the middle of the night when there's no traffic, I wear the seatbelt. It's all about being prepared, because in the middle of the night, an animal can run out in front of the car, or my car may fail and I lose steering control, or just something odd. But the point is, yes, the hurricane season likely to be very active, but any season, one storm is the storm that you need to prepare for, and no one can tell you what season that's going to be.
Well, that's a good point. Even if there are a low number of named storms, if your community gets a direct hit from a Cat 3 hurricane, for your community, that was a terribly catastrophic hurricane season, right?
Right. That's right. Just the one. And Andrew, Hurricane Andrew, of course, is sort of like the poster child for a late season storm in a season that was not likely to be active, but it was bad.
Well, that's a good point. That was the A storm in late August, right? So if you go to early August that year, people were probably saying, hey, maybe we're not going to have any storms this year. It's already August. We haven't even used the A storm. And then here comes Hurricane Andrew. So that's a good perspective that it doesn't take a lot of storms to produce a catastrophic impact.
And related to that, we spend so much time and effort in the early part of the season talking about get ready, get ready, get ready. And then of course, we usually go a month or two where there's very little happening, and people start to lose that. You guys said what? But people have to remember the hurricane season, the worst storms, the most intense storms are typically from late August into mid-September, typically. But it's all about getting ready now, preparing before the storm comes. You either pay now or you pay later. You pay later, you're going to pay more.
Alan, this is five-star gold award advice you're giving us here. I appreciate you coming on the podcast today, and we'll continue to follow your work and your career. I know you're officially retired, but word on the street is you're still going to a lot of workshops. You're still going to conferences, right, communicating. I can just tell you this is a passion for you. It's not just a job that you say, hey, I want to walk away from it. It seems like you're connected with people, and
right,
and meteorology is a passion for you. So we're excited to keep following your communication online. We learned a lot from you today on the podcast, just about how to think of these storms, how to communicate about them. I think that'll help us all be a little bit safer this upcoming hurricane season.
Excellent. Thank you.
Well, hey, it seems like we just got started. When you hang out with Alan Seals, you're like, you want more. If you want to hear more about his insights and adventures, check out the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast. It's a companion episode where Alan Seals will come back to share more about his journey growing up in the Empire State, travels around the country where he eventually came to the Gulf Coast. You're going to hear about more about this adventure on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast, a companion episode with Alan Seals.